Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 54, The Worst of the Persecutors. Over the last two episodes, we've covered the first 2 years of the Great Persecution in the East, and then in the West under the Tetrarchy. In this episode, we look at how the persecution was continued in the East under the Second Tetrarchy, following the abdication of Diocletian and Maximian. Before we get into that, though, we need to cover the last group of martyrs Eusebius records in Palestine during the first phase of the persecution under Diocletian. We last left the Christians of the East in November 304, when in Caesarea, the governor Urbanus was throwing Christians to the wild beasts in the Hippodrome. A group of six Christians approached him, announcing their willingness to be martyred alongside their brethren. Their names were Timolaus of Pontus, Alexander of Gaza, Dionysius of Tripoli, the subdeacon Romulus of Diospolis, and the two Egyptians Paisus and Alexander. Urbanus had them all imprisoned for an extended number of months. They were soon joined by two other men. First, a confessor named Agapius of Gaza, not to be confused with the other Agapius of Gaza, who survived the beasts in the arena. This Agapius had made a habit of visiting his fellow confessors in the prisons. Second was one Dionysius of Palestine, who attended to the confessors by bringing them food and drink. Finally, on March 24th, 305, all eight were beheaded on Urbanus's orders. They are the last known Christian martyrs from the reign of Diocletian. Though the year had begun in bloodshed, 305 would see the first respite from the persecution for the Christians of the Eastern Empire. The reason for this was the succession of the Second Tetrarchy. You'll recall from two episodes ago that Diocletian became severely ill after departing from Rome during the early winter of 303. By the end of the following year, his health had taken such a turn for the worst that rumors began to spread that he was dead. Lactantius states that some believed news of Diocletian's death was being suppressed until Galerius could arrive in Nicomedia. But as things turned out, Diocletian was not to die just yet. He recovered enough from his chronic illness to make his first public appearance on March 1st, 305, after months of being hidden from public view in the palace. But the man who now appeared before his subjects was barely recognizable. The vigorous Senior Augustus, who had restored the Roman Empire and acted as Jupiter's vice-regent on Earth, was gone. What remained was an emaciated and weakened old man. To add further insult to injury, there is evidence to suggest that the emperor's mind never fully recovered either. The age of Diocletian had come to an end. Galerius arrived not long after, and according to Lactantius, immediately began working on Diocletian to abdicate and appoint new emperors. It seems the original plan for succession was hashed out back in the autumn of 303 when the four emperors met in northern Italy, likely Milan, before proceeding on to Rome for their triumphal and anniversary celebrations. Galerius, you may recall, had to depart early to deal with a barbarian invasion along the Danube. The exact nature of this succession plan is not entirely certain, but we do know that Diocletian and Maximian were to jointly abdicate, and Constantius and Galerius would succeed them as the new Augusti, with Constantius taking on Diocletian's role as the senior emperor. What is less clear and more controversial is the matter of the appointment of the new Caesars. Many scholars have argued Diocletian wanted to create a merit-based system which disregarded dynastic hereditary succession. On this view, the two adult sons of the Western emperors, Constantine and Maxentius, were deliberately passed over for imperial appointment by Diocletian. However, other historians have pointed out that this notion is anachronistically modern. Virtually all of the Roman emperors of the 3rd century had made their sons either Caesar or Co-Augustus. Diocletian had no sons and thus adopted Maximian. The first tetrarchy had been a dynastic system, bound by both adoption and marriage. The Caesars were the son-in-laws of the Augusti. Therefore, though we of course can't be entirely certain, the original plan in 303 does seem to have been that Constantius's son Constantine would become Caesar in the east under Galerius, and Maximian's son Maxentius would become Caesar in the west under Constantius. Both men were of the right age and had the proper dynastic and professional qualifications. Constantine had long served as a tribune in Galerius's army, and Maxentius probably had some military experience as well, in addition to being Galerius's son-in-law. It's even speculated that Constantine's first wife, Minervina, may have been related to Diocletian. Just as familial ties had cemented the first tetrarchy, so too would the second tetrarchy be bound together. But this situation was not what Galerius desired. As we discussed when going over the reasons for the Great Persecution, part of why Galerius had pressed Diocletian on the Christian question was to isolate his Western colleague. Both of the new prospective Caesars would be loyal to Constantius. Galerius wanted two Caesars who would be loyal to him. Once Constantius was out of the way, Galerius could assume the role of Senior Augustus. So over the spring of 305, Galerius worked on the recovered Diocletian to change the succession plan. Lactantius provides intimate details on these conversations, and although his account is somewhat tendentious, he probably got the gist of what happened. Eventually, Galerius got his way. The date set was May 1st. Elements of the Eastern Roman army assembled outside Nicomedia. A platform was erected, and a pillar and a statue of Jupiter placed above the very spot where Diocletian had been proclaimed emperor over 20 years earlier. Diocletian addressed the assembled troops with tears in his eyes. He related how he was tired, fatigued, and would now step down from the imperial office, handing over the reins of power to stronger hands. The Caesars would now succeed the Augusti. Finally, he declared that as his final act as senior emperor, he would appoint the new Caesars. Only the senior Augustus had the authority to add new members to the imperial college. According to Lactantius, all eyes were on Constantine, who stood beside the emperor on the tribunal as Diocletian prepared to make the announcement. But to the shock of the assembled officers and troops, Diocletian instead announced the names of Flavius Valerius Severus as Caesar of the West and Gaius Valerius Galerius Maximinus Daya as Caesar of the East. It's doubtful the scene was as dramatic as Lactantius claims. The senior officers, at least, must have known what the plan was ahead of time. Nevertheless, many were no doubt surprised, especially given Constantine's career in the East and his physical proximity to Diocletian during the ceremony itself. Galerius then produced Maximinus Daya, to whom Diocletian turned. Removing his own purple robe, Diocletian draped it on the shoulders of the new Caesar. On the very same day over in Milan, Maximian did likewise as he placed his imperial robe on Severus. With that, Diocletian stepped down from the tribunal, and after 2 decades of restoring the Roman Empire, became Diocles once again. He left his capital of Nicomedia to retire to his fortress palace in the Dalmatian city of Spoletum, modern-day Split in Croatia. Maximian, in turn, retired to his estates in southern Italy. With the appointment of new emperors came territorial changes as well. In the west, Constantius received the Spanish provinces, and Severus was assigned Italy and Africa. Galerius added Anatolia to his Balkan and Thracian domains, while Maximinus was given the large Diocese of the East, consisting of the Levant and Egypt. We'll cover events in the west next episode, as today I want to continue the story in the east, starting off by introducing the new Eastern Caesar, Maximinus Dia. Galerius had an illegitimate son named Candidianus, born of a concubine, and he had induced his wife Valeria, the daughter of Diocletian, to adopt the boy. However, Candidianus was no more than 10 years old in 305, and so Galerius was forced to look at his extended family when proposing new Caesars. Severus's relation to Galerius is unknown, though he may have been a relative by blood or marriage. Maximinus, however, was Galerius's next closest male blood relative, for he was Galerius's nephew, being the son of his sister. Like the new Western Caesar, Severus, Maximinus had already served at least some time as a military commander. Though Lactantius belittles both men's earlier careers, the new Caesars must have had some experience for Diocletian to accept them. Another reason Diocletian may have accepted Galerius's nomination of his nephew was a superstitious one. Maximinus was born on the same day, the 20th of November, and perhaps even the same year, that Diocletian became emperor. Similar to the way Maximian's shared birthday with Diocletian was regarded as supernatural confirmation. The last thing we need to note about Maximinus Dia is also the most relevant to our story. In addition to blood, Maximinus also shared with Uncle Galerius a fanatical devotion to the Roman gods and a violent hatred of Christianity. As we shall soon see, Maximinus didn't just match his uncle in persecuting Christians, he exceeded him both in cruelty and ingenuity. Of the emperors who perpetrated the great persecution, Maximinus Dia was arguably the worst, for he possessed both the brutal savagery of Galerius as well as the strategic temperament of Diocletian. A combination which allowed him to channel his hatred into a coordinated campaign against the early church. The changeover in emperors caused the first major respite for the church as Maximinus set up his court in Antioch, while Galerius was establishing himself as Augustus in the Moesian capital of Serdica, modern-day Sofia in Bulgaria. The lapse, though, was not absolute. Around November or December 305, a Christian presbyter named Stephen was martyred in the Theban city of Cleopatras under the governor Satrius Arianus. The governor allowed the presbyter time to reflect before rendering judgment and offered Stephen the opportunity to sacrifice three times. Stephen remained steadfast, however, and so was put to death. This martyrdom is noteworthy for two reasons. First, it shows that even during a lull in the persecution, executions of Christians still occurred. Second, the record of Stephen's trial was only discovered in modern times. Prior to that, Stephen of Lyonios was a previously unattested martyr, appearing in none of the hagiographical sources which have come down to us, even later legendary accounts. He was a presbyter in a small local village, and his memory failed to spread beyond those confines. This means that the martyrs' names who do survive today had to have achieved a measure of prominence among multiple Christian communities. Otherwise, they would have been forgotten like Stephen. Many martyrs have been lost to the dustbin of history. The respite from persecution afforded many Christians who had fled the opportunity to return home. Such was the case with Peter, Bishop of Alexandria. You'll remember that Peter had been in exile since 303. When he returned to his native land, the Egyptian Pope was soon faced with the same divisive problem which had faced his predecessor Dionysius half a century earlier. How should the lapsed be brought back into the church? This led to Peter issuing his famous canonical letter, an encyclical which was circulated probably some months before Easter 306. Some scholars have suggested that the canonical letter may even have originally been part of the Bishop of Alexandria's festal letter. The festal letter was an annually dispatched epistle, the primary purpose of which was to announce the date of Easter, hence the name. As we'll see as the narrative continues, the bishops of Alexandria would frequently use this platform to address other issues which were facing the church at the time. Peter displayed a marked degree of moderation in the penances he laid down. Realizing that the threat of persecution still hung over everyone's heads, the bishop did not want the lapsed to abandon the church if they felt there was no hope of readmittance. So he laid down his canons as follows. Christians who had lapsed under torture or imprisonment were already counted as having served 3 years of penance, counting the 3 years since the persecution began. Those who had lapsed under torture would be readmitted to communion after a period of only 40 days, or if they had a witness, were readmitted immediately and were regarded as confessors. Those who lapsed only under imprisonment would be readmitted after only one more year. Those who had lapsed without being subjected to torture or imprisonment were instead to be excluded from communion for 3 to 4 years. Christians who used bribes or surrendered property to avoid sacrificing were not excluded from communion at all. In fact, Peter saw this as a good thing, giving up worldly possessions to preserve one's salvation, serving God instead of mammon. Even zealous Christians who volunteered themselves to the authorities were only rebuked, but otherwise regarded as being in full communion. Christians who used their non-Christian slaves to perform sacrifice in their stead were given a penance of only 6 months, while Christians who forced their Christian slaves to sacrifice were given a penance of 3 years. Christian slaves themselves who had sacrificed were only excluded from communion for 1 year. The only people Peter took a harder line with were clergy and unrepentant apostates. The latter were considered cursed, while the former were relieved of their clerical offices, but otherwise accepted back into the fold. In laying down these pastoral decisions, Peter was asserting his role as Primate Bishop of Egypt, showing compassion to the repentant lapsed, and also attempting to show solidarity with the confessors and martyrs. Unfortunately, not everyone was happy with the Pope's approach, as we'll get to later. In the many months which followed the succession of the Second Tetrarchy, uncertainty had fallen over the East. Christianity was still a capital crime, and the extended lull filled many Christians with grave unease. Finally, though, as the spring of 306 rolled around, it became very clear to all that the Great Persecution was back in full swing. In their enforcement of the persecution, Galerius and Maximinus were aided by the imperial census. The empire-wide imperial census appears to have occurred on a 5-year cycle, and so this was nothing new. However, Galerius added an innovation. Normally, taxation was limited to the rural countryside and city dwellers who owned property. Now, though, Galerius was going to extend taxation to all city dwellers, regardless of whether or not they owned property. This move was greatly resented by the inhabitants of the empire. Even Maximinus Daya appears to have disapproved of it. However, whatever disagreement the Caesar had with his uncle, he put aside. With the entire urban population of the empire now enrolled in the census, Maximinus would be able to use the public registers to diligently implement Diocletian's fourth edict. The Caesar directed a letter to the local city magistrates to use the new census rolls to enforce the decree of universal sacrifice. With the names of every citizen in the cities now on record, officials were sent to gather all men, women, and children to the temples to offer sacrifices and pour out libations to the immortal gods of Rome. With the renewal of persecution, Peter of Alexandria was forced to flee his city once again. Peter had defended his decision to flee on biblical grounds, but as had been the case with Cyprian and Dionysius before him, not everyone agreed with his position. For some, flight was cowardice and perhaps even tantamount to apostasy. Among those who took issue with Peter's flight was the new bishop of Lycopolis, Meletius. We'll likely never know the full story of Meletius's career, but it appears that following the resumption of persecution and Peter's second exile, Meletius decided to take it upon himself to perform the duties which, from his perspective, the cowardly Bishop of Alexandria was neglecting to do. You'll remember from two episodes ago that the previous Bishop of Lycopolis, Apollonius, had apostatized. It's not too hard to imagine, then, that Meletius would have held such hard-line attitudes. He had seen the damage done to the Christians in the Thebaid by the apostasy of his predecessor, as well as the other lapsed bishops who still clung to their offices. In addition, not only were there lapsed bishops, there were also bishops who had been imprisoned by the imperial government and were therefore unable to attend to their flocks or ordain new clergy to serve their parishioners. Meletius and his allies viewed this as a pastoral and administrative void which needed to be filled. With the Pope in flight and many bishops in prison, someone needed to step up and restore the liturgical and sacramental life of the church. So Meletius began ordaining clergy outside his jurisdiction, and without the approval of Peter. Four imprisoned bishops, loyal to Peter, had their authority usurped as Meletius began ordaining clergy for their churches in Lower Egypt. Meletius defended his actions by claiming Peter and his bishops were no longer caring for the needs of the Christian people. In response, the four bishops wrote a letter to Meletius, rebuking him for his actions. They declared his acts were invalid, and that he should have consulted Peter before taking such measures. They defended the Bishop of Alexandria by asserting that Peter's parish visitors were attending to the needs of the people. Remember that Peter had commissioned laymen and lower-ranking clergy to act as traveling bishops for the purpose of communication. The bishops also disputed Meletius's claim that they had forgotten their congregations during their imprisonment. Their letter does not appear to have halted Meletius's activities, though, and the Bishop of Lycopolis continued to expand his network of followers throughout Egypt. We will return to Meletius two episodes from now. All four bishops were eventually martyred. One of them was named Phileas of Thmuis. Phileas was an Egyptian of noble rank who had served in the local imperial administration and was also a philosopher. He had converted to Christianity late in his life, and both his wife and children were still pagans. Though Meletius claimed Phileas had neglected his pastoral duties, Eusebius actually preserves a letter by Phileas to his congregation, informing them about the persecution in Alexandria. In the letter, Phileas describes how the prefect Clodius Colchianus and his staff were making a bloody spectacle out of torturing Christians, mocking and then beating their victims with every tool from cudgels to whips. Christians had their limbs tied and stretched so the torturers could apply their instruments to their sides, stomachs, legs, and cheeks. Other Christians were hung by one hand to a pillar so they could be lifted up and experience excruciating pain in their joints. Others had their whole bodies fastened to pillars and were suspended above the ground. As the weight of their bodies pulled them down, the bonds became tighter and more crushing. The prefect found it beneficial to leave them in this state, hoping they would give in before they finally died. As Christians were placed on the rack, onlookers could see the many gory wounds inflicted on their naked bodies as they were being stretched. Some Christians died under this torture. Others were sent back to the prisons barely alive, and still some even recovered while in prison with medical treatment, growing even more ardent in their faith in the process. Phileas hoped his account of the heroic martyrdoms would harden the resolve of the Church of Thmuis. Phileas himself was brought before the prefect a total of 5 times in the familiar cycle of interrogation, imprisonment, and torture. Finally, on February 7th, 307, he was brought before Colchianus' tribunal for the 5th and final time. During the interrogation of the bishop, the prefect made a mocking reference to the presbyter Pareus. We discussed Pareus briefly before the narrative break. He was the presbyter often called Origen the Younger and had been the teacher of Eusebius' spiritual father, Pamphilus. Even though he was head of the catechetical school of Alexandria, Pareus compromised in some way to obtain release, a fact Colchianus tried to use to weaken Phileas' resolve. In addition, during his final trial, Phileas was joined by another prestigious convert to Christianity, Philo Romus. Philo Romus had also served the government as a tribune and previously enjoyed a high station with a bodyguard of soldiers. Also like Phileas, Philo Romus had a pagan family. The prefect, the other officials, and even their relatives asked the 2 men to take pity on their wives and children and offer sacrifice. But the bishop and laymen were resolute in their devotion to Christ, and so Colchianus had them both beheaded. Switching gears from Egypt, we now need to circle back and cover the events in the Holy Land. The first martyr Eusebius mentions in Palestine under Maximinus' rule was his close friend Apphianus of Lycia. Apphianus was from a wealthy Lycian family and in his youth had studied at the school of Beirut in Phoenicia. But high moral fiber and bodily self-control turned him toward Christianity, and he eventually settled in Caesarea. There he joined Eusebius as a student in the household of Pamphilus. On March 31st, 306, when the governor Urbanus was performing the sacrifices ordered by the emperors, Apphianus, without word or warning to Pamphilus or his fellow students, secretly departed to the public temples. As Urbanus prepared to pour out a libation to the gods, Apphianus made his way past the governor's bodyguards, seized Urbanus' hand, and gently exhorted the magistrate to turn away from idols and demons and worship the one true God. For this act of evangelism, the governor's guards quickly set upon Apphianus, beating him severely and stomping on his face before throwing him in the prisons. The following day, Apphianus was stretched in the stocks before Urbanus had his sides torn down to the bone, and then had the scraps of the martyr's flesh placed on his face, before finally having Apphianus's face disfigured beyond recognition. The governor proceeded to interrogate Apphianus, who remained steadfast and simply confessed he was a Christian. Enraged, Urbanus subjected him to a new torture, clothing his feet in flammable cloths and lifting him up with a device for all to see. The officials continued to try to get more information out of him, but Apphianus remained silent. The martyr survived until the following day, when he was brought before the tribunal one last time. The authorities tied stones around his feet, and on April 2nd, Apphianus was cast into the sea. According to Eusebius, Apphianus' courage and perseverance moved many in the city to confess Christ. Around the same time, probably on the following day, Eusebius mentions another martyr in the Phoenician city of Tyre named Ulpian, who was killed in a similar way. After being subjected to various forms of torture, Ulpian was sewed up in a sack alongside a dog and a snake, and then was cast into the sea. The next martyrdom Eusebius records was that of Agapius of Gaza, the man who had been imprisoned alongside the Montanist Thecla 2 years earlier. The Caesar Maximinus Dii himself was in Caesarea to celebrate his birthday on November 20th, 306. The governor Urbanus had earned the emperor's favor with his enthusiastic enforcement of the persecution, and gleefully assisted his sovereign in putting on a spectacle in the hippodrome to celebrate the imperial birthday, full of wild beasts and gladiators. Agapius was once again brought out to the arena, this time with a placard placed on him with the word Christian written on it. Alongside Agapius was a slave who had murdered his master. In a display of imperial clemency, Maximinus pardoned the slave, and told Agapius he would do the same for him if he renounced his Christian faith. Agapius instead defied the emperor to his face by delivering a public apology before the crowd and proclaiming the truth of Christianity. Enraged, the Caesar ordered the bears and leopards being restrained to be let loose. Agapius rushed to meet the bear head-on and was brutally savaged. He managed to survive the attack, however, and on the following day, Agapius was brought back out of the prison. Stones were tied to his body, and Agapius was also hurled into the sea. By the time spring of 307 rolled around, the imperial authorities had begun condemning Christians to work in the mines. Being forced to work in the harsh conditions of the imperial mines was often a death sentence by a slower means. In the eastern provinces, purple porphyry stone was mined down in the Thebaid, while copper was mined in Phano, south of the Dead Sea in Palestine. Another notable mining area of unspecified precious metals was located further north in Cilicia. On April 2nd, a young consecrated Christian virgin from Tyre named Theodosia, not yet 18 years of age, made her way to the governor's court in Caesarea, where she approached a group of confessors. Theodosia asked the confessors to remember her in their prayers after they had gone to be with the Lord. Urbanus's soldiers arrested her as the governor burst into an immodest rage, acting as though Theodosia had personally offended him. When she refused to sacrifice, Urbanus had her sides and breasts savagely tortured. Theodosia remained steadfast, however, cheerfully informing the governor of how pleased she was to be counted a martyr. Urbanus, feeling this girl was mocking him, had Theodosia thrown into the sea. As for the confessors, Urbanus demurred from executing them right then and there, and instead condemned them all to the copper mines of Phano. Over the course of the year, Urbanus continued to use different methods to persecute recalcitrant Christians in Palestine. On November 5th, his activities reached a crescendo during a single hour where he sentenced a large group of Christians to various forms of punishment. Young Christian men were castrated, while Christian maidens were sent to brothel keepers to be sexually brutalized. Domninus, a locally known Christian youth who had previously been condemned to the copper mines, was instead burned alive. Three other young Christian men were condemned to fight as gladiators for the emperor's amusement, while an elderly priest named Auxentius was delivered to the beasts in the arena. Silvanus, the bishop of Gaza, and his companions were sent to the mines of Phano. but not before they each had one of their ankles pierced with a hot iron, depriving them of the use of that foot. Most importantly for Eusebius, his spiritual father Pamphilus and his companions, many of whom were Eusebius's fellow students, were at last arrested. After threats failed, Urbanus had Pamphilus's sides lacerated down to the bone. When the presbyter still refused to sacrifice, he was sent to the prisons. Pamphilus would remain there for over 2 years. Urbanus was at the high point of his imperial career. His brutal enforcement of the persecution had made him a favorite of Maximinus, and the governor was a guest at the Caesar's table. However, sometime in the winter of 307-308, Urbanus met an ignoble end. For reasons Eusebius does not state, Urbanus was suddenly denounced, stripped of his rank, and then tried and executed by the emperor. The removal of Urbanus may have given the Christians of Palestine hope that the persecution would be relaxed. Enforcement of imperial law depended heavily on the disposition of the provincial governor. Unfortunately, it was not to be. The new governor was a veteran soldier and loyal crony of Maximinus's named Valerius Firmilianus, who somehow managed to surpass his predecessor in the ferocity of his persecution of Christians. The emperor picked his governors well. In the spring of 308, at the city of Diocesarea, Firmilianus tried 97 Coptic confessors who had been sent to him from the porphyry mines of Upper Egypt. The confessors, men, women, and children, each had their left ankle pierced with hot irons, and then had their right eye gouged out and the socket seared, before being dispatched to the copper mines of Phano. Not long after, as spring moved to summer, the three youths previously condemned to fight as gladiators before Maximinus in Caesarea were also mutilated and condemned to the mines, following their refusal to train and fight. Also at this time, a group of Christians from Gaza who had illegally assembled to read scripture suffered the same punishment under Firmilianus. On July 25th, two Christian women were condemned in Caesarea by the governor. After being threatened with sexual violence, Enatha of Gaza denounced the Caesar Maximinus for appointing such a wicked governor. Firmilianus had Enatha's whole body marred and her sides viciously lacerated. The torture was carried on multiple times in the course of a single hour, which eventually wore out the torturers. Another young Christian woman named Valentina of Caesarea cried out from the crowd, rebuking the governor for the merciless way he treated her sister in Christ. Firmilianus ordered Valentina to sacrifice, but she responded by kicking over the pagan altar. The governor proceeded to have her skin flayed with iron combs. When his bloodlust was finally satisfied, Firmilianus had both women burnt alive. On the same day, a confessor named Paul was beheaded, but not before he gave a long prayer of thanksgiving to God, asking that the unbelievers of all stripes would come to faith in Jesus Christ. Firmilianus continued the persecution through the summer, and once again received a large number of Coptic Christian confessors, 130 in all. These two he had mutilated on their left ankle and right eye, before dispatching some to the mines of Phano, while others he sent north to the mines of Cilicia. As 308 drew to a close, however, a second respite occurred for the Eastern Christians, as imperial attention was diverted elsewhere. What exactly was it that could draw away Galerius and Maximinus from their beloved persecution of Christians? Could it have anything to do with Galerius's altering of the succession plan? Next episode, we'll return to the West to look at the aftermath of both the Great Persecution and the change in emperors. Though the persecution in the West will be officially brought to an end, peace will continue to elude both church and state. Violent schism will quickly flare up within the Christian communities of Rome and North Africa. Meanwhile, matters at the imperial level will begin the sequence of events, which will eventually reduce the number of emperors from 4 to 2, before finally one man will emerge victorious as the sole master of the Roman Empire, Constantine.